I've got something that's totally gonna knock your socks off. It is an unbelievable conversation with the most amazingly super bad woman. I'm gonna do something a little bit differently today on the podcast. I want the podcast to not only be a place where you hear about women sharing their breast cancer experiences, but I also want it to be a place where you can meet really amazing women who do the coolest things. Because after your breast cancer journey, sometimes it's hard to find joy in life. And because you have that nagging thought, is my cancer going to come back? And you just get caught up in this fear cycle. Well, one way that I've found to curb those thoughts is to find joy and brand new interests. Find something that's going to spark your curiosity and your excitement and just get you back into life again. Well, I had the pleasure of sitting down and speaking with Dr. Melanie Windridge, who is the author of the book Aurora, In Search of the Northern Lights. And she's also hiked Mount Everest and is a plasma physicist. Talk about somebody who can spark your love to explore. So I am thrilled beyond measure to introduce to you Melanie as she tells us more about her love of the aurora.
I work on fusion energy in general. I'm a plasma physicist, it's called. So I studied physics at university, and then I got interested in this new type of energy, which is fusion, which is actually what happens in the sun and the stars. And so Scientists are trying to recreate it here on Earth as a clean, sustainable energy source. And so I did a PhD in fusion, and I became a plasma physicist. And then it just so happens that the aurora is also a plasma. And so towards the end of my PhD, I began thinking, I'm a plasma physicist. I should see this most spectacular natural like plasma phenomenon.
Yeah.
And so I got interested in going to see it. And it took a while to go and see it because, to be honest, it can be a little bit expensive to go to the Arctic.
I wondered.
So, but I finally went. I actually went as part of a course a couple of years after my PhD because I was still plugged into the networks, you know, like the university networks. And I saw an advertisement for students to join this. It was called an Arctic science course.
Oh, and it was fantastic.
It was kind of like distance. You could do most of it at home, like distance learning. Although if you're at a university, you could actually get credits for it, but you didn't have to be. You could be like an independent student. And anyway, so, and it had this 1 week of like field work in Arctic Sweden.
Wow.
And so I thought that sounds cool. And I signed up, and it was really cool because during the week we had lots of lectures. There was a, I can't remember the name of it now, but it was like a Swedish institute, like a space institute or something. I was up there. And so we had lectures during the day, not just about aurora, but we learned about things like about like Arctic ecology and snowflakes and avalanches and like loads of just different Arctic science things.
Yeah.
And it was great. And in the evening we'd go out and look for the aurora. And so that was my first experience of seeing the aurora.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the most amazing of experiences. It was what I would describe as a quiet display, which means you don't get very much movement, but you just see like the green streaks in the sky.
Okay.
And it moves a little bit. But just seeing it, it's crazy. It kind of grabs you, or it grabbed me. It was like you see it and you think, this is just the most incredible thing. And I felt so grateful to be seeing it. And then, of course, it just sort of makes you want to see it more.
Again and again.
Because you want to see it better. And also I got interested in like, what must it have felt like, or what must people have thought like before we knew what the science was, like the old polar explorers, for example, or the indigenous people. Like, so I got all interested in that. And so I ended up writing a book about it. So that first trip was like the beginning of this long journey that lasted several years. And I just, love it. I just love it.
Yes. It's just fascinating. So from what I understand, are there different, like if the aurora is showing at night, will it go for 30 or 45 minutes and then go down a bit? Or is it a display all night long?
It actually does, like you say, kind of come in waves.
Almost. Okay.
It does this like cycle thing. They call it a substorm, this sort of small cycle where the aurora kind of builds To a point. It's like you, if you were standing sort of in the Arctic underneath what we call like the auroral zone, then it's it sort of starts off as a band across the sky in the north, just like an east-west stretched out band in the north, and then gradually the band will sort of move overhead, start moving towards the south. And then it'll get to a point which is called the breakup phase, where it starts to twist and move more, and this is the more active part of it. And then generally it will quieten down again and move back.
Yeah,
and that can that cycle can last like half an hour, 45 minutes, and you can repeat like a few times during the night if the conditions are active.
Oh, yes. And where are the best places to see the aurora?
Ooh, that depends. There are never really easy answers. You can see the aurora. Well, first of all, there's the northern lights and the southern lights.
Okay.
So we generally talk about the northern lights, and that's because the aurora happens in rings around the poles. Imagine the globe, and imagine it's not right at the North Pole, but imagine that there's a ring kind of spread out from the North Pole. And it goes between the latitudes of about, let's say, 60 and 70 degrees latitude, thereabouts. It moves a bit. So it's this ring around the poles, and you get them in the north and you get them in the south. And this area where you most often see the aurora is called the aurora zone. And in the north, it goes right through. So it'll go through like Iceland, Greenland, north of Canada, Alaska, top of Siberia, and then the north of Scandinavia. And that's the aurora zone in the north. So there's lots of land up there. So there's people up there and people actually see it. Whereas in the south, the aurora zone actually mostly goes through the sea, the Antarctic Ocean, and a little bit through Antarctica. But so, and there aren't very many people down in Antarctica. So it's like, more penguins probably see the southern lights than people. So, so that's why you hear people talking mostly about the northern lights, because it's just much easier to see the northern lights. And so then, you can go to any of those countries that I just talked about to see them. But there are advantages. Some places are slightly better than others because of, it's because of weather.
Okay.
The weather can ruin everything.
Yeah, I was reading about that because with cloud cover and that colder temperatures are better. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so in general, because clouds are like the worst thing for the aurora, because the aurora actually happens really high up. It happens at like 100 kilometers up or like 60 miles up in the atmosphere or higher, like stretching up higher. Whereas most of the weather that we experience, like the clouds and things, is usually below about 20 kilometers up, so much lower. So any clouds are just going to block the view and get in the way. So you need to try and avoid clouds, really. So that's why colder places where there's less precipitation can be good, or inland, like away from in the middle of continents, away from the coastlines, can generally be better. But it depends on how much time you have. Like the people who live on the coast of Norway, for example, they see loads of lovely aurora. But if you've only got 2 days, let's say, to see it, you want to go and maximize the chances.
Yes. Oh, how incredible. Can you tell me what makes the colors in the aurora?
Oh, yeah, that's actually comes down to atomic physics.
Okay.
And this is something that I find like really fascinating about the aurora, is like the scales, because when you're thinking about like how the aurora is formed, you're thinking about space, you're thinking about like charged particles coming from the sun and interacting with the earth, and you're on these huge scales of space. And then when you talk about the colors of the aurora, you're down to like the very opposite scales, where you're looking at atoms. And so it's still tiny, so it's incredible, like the different scales. But basically, the reason you get the colors is because these charged particles, electrically charged particles called electrons, get accelerated into the Earth's upper atmosphere. And so these fast moving electrons bash into what's in our atmosphere, which is mostly oxygen, nitrogen, and a few other gases like hydrogen and a few others. And when they bash into these molecules or atoms in the atmosphere, it's called exciting them. They basically give them a bit of energy. Mm-hmm. And when those atoms in the atmosphere release that energy again, they release it as light. Okay. And so that's why you see the aurora. And then the different atoms release different colors. And actually, sometimes it gets a little bit more complicated because some atoms can release multiple colors depending on like how excited they get.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah, so you get lots of different colors, but the ones you see most often is a green color, a bright green. And that comes from oxygen. And so, yeah, that's the most common color that you'll see. Yeah. But you also sometimes will see, particularly in pictures, it's harder to see it with the naked eye, but in pictures, if you look to the top of the picture, you can sometimes see a red color, and that's also from oxygen, but it only comes much higher up. In fact, if you look at, there are pictures of the aurora from space, from the International Space Station, and then you can see this whole stretched out. You can see how tall they are in the atmosphere, and you'll be able to see a little bit of red high up, and then the rest of it is green much lower down.
Yes, and then
you also get things like blues and pinky colors from nitrogen lower down in the atmosphere too.
Oh, what a moving experience to be under there and just see all of that.
It is. I think it's interesting because when the aurora is quiet, I describe it as quiet, as in it's not moving very much. It's just this like band of green, and it might twist a little bit. It's a bit like watching clouds drift across the sky really slowly. It's like that kind of speed of movement, and that can be quite calm. And so if you're sitting watching something like that, you just sort of like, you know, you're seeing the colors, and although you are freezing, remember, at the same time, but it is quite calm.
Right.
But then when it gets more active, when it starts to move a little bit more and you start seeing some more colors, I mean, it suddenly can just quickly change. And every now and then it does this thing, which reminds me of, you know, if you have a piano and you go down the keys.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see the keys like up and down, up and down, up and down. It does a thing like that sometimes where you see like pillars in the sky, just like sort of like oscillating or flashing a bit. It just reminds me of piano keys.
Yeah.
And when you see that, then it's not calm at all. Then you're like jumping up and down and going, my God, this is amazing. Like, do it again.
Oh, I bet.
So it's really fun.
Incredibly magical.
Yeah, it's a complete difference.
Oh, and I heard that there is a superstition that you can't whistle. You're not supposed to whistle at the aurora. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, it's something like the Norwegians would say, or the Sami people from northern Scandinavia, I think. There are various different like stories and myths around the aurora, which is interesting. And one of them is that you shouldn't like tease the aurora or make fun of the aurora. And I think the whistling kind of comes in like that as well, you know, like you've got to respect the aurora. And so otherwise, so the whistling is sort of frowned upon. But there are lots of different stories that are quite interesting and quite funny, some of them. I remember when I was writing my book, I traveled up to northern Norway, and I went out one day with a reindeer herder, a Sami reindeer herder.
Oh.
And we sat and spoke about the aurora and his experiences in childhood and things like that. And one of the things he said to me that I thought was quite funny is he said that when he was young, the aurora were natural babysitters. That was called them. He said that the parents would tell their children that they mustn't come home late, otherwise the aurora would get them.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny because they said that you realize that some of these things, which just can be so special to us, can be so normal and commonplace and everyday for them if you actually live up there. I mean, it's still beautiful, of course, but he said that, you know, for them, it's just like the weather, or it's not that exciting.
Yeah. And for us, it could be a once in a lifetime type thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Completely different perspective.
Oh, that is amazing. So do you have more plans to go see it?
Yeah, I hope so. Of course, now with COVID, it's a little bit difficult, but I do actually have, I've been asked to go on a trip with New Scientist magazine in January. Yeah, in January. So that's to northern Norway. And so I'll be the expert on their trip, and I'll like give some talks and tell people about the aurora. And so that's next January. So fingers crossed that will all go ahead, and I'll be able to see it again then, because I didn't yeah, I didn't see the aurora at all last year because I didn't go anywhere.
Right. So, do you try to see it every year?
Well, not really, but it's just that things happen, like things come up. So I think, you know, since I started writing my book, like the first time I saw the aurora was 2013. And then I do think I saw them kind of every year for a couple of years, but at different levels. Like I've really only seen a couple of good displays. Most of the time when you go to see the aurora, it's what I call quiet. Okay. And it's still nice and it's still magical, but it's kind of rare to get the faster movement and the colors. And so you always find yourself kind of happy to go again, because you know you get another chance to maybe see something bigger and brighter. And
yeah,
I've been quite a few times. I think I've been on maybe 7 or 8 different aurora trips now. And yeah, if I could do one a year, that's fine by me.
Yes.
It's something I'd like to do going forward, because I, as I said, I'm going with New Scientist next year, and I've been invited to go on some cruises as well. Unfortunately, they were cancelled because of COVID, but mm-hmm. I'm sure they will happen again. And I do enjoy the trips because it brings people together, and that's what I like best about the aurora. I think I love the fact that people want to share their stories with me. Like every time I went out and gave lectures or, you know, talks about my book and about the aurora, people would always come up at the end and they tell me about their experiences. And I loved that. I love that kind of connection. And that's what inspired me actually to start Aurora Stories.
Oh,
which,
good. I
was, a blog.
Yes.
Yeah. It was a blog, and I'm now starting it as a membership. And that's kind of inspired by the fact that, like, I missed that connection through COVID and the fact that we're not doing talks and things anymore. Mm-hmm. I realized that it's harder to have that kind of connection. And so I thought that if I could do something that helps people like get together, even if it's just virtually, because you bond over something that, you know, that's a common interest,
yes.
Something that you both appreciate or like all enjoy. And going back to the trips, like the trips are lovely because they're like that in like supersized, because suddenly you get all these people together who love this particular thing and they have this common interest. And so not only is the trip fun because, yeah, hopefully you're going to be seeing the aurora, and even if you don't, you're in a really cool environment in the Arctic and you're doing new things, but it's just the people that really make it, these people who have a common interest. And so I hope that if I can like bring more people together through an Aurora Stories membership, then in the future we can also run some trips and people can connect with each other.
Experience. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, it is. I was reading through some of the blog posts and stories from different people, and it is wonderful because it kind of takes you to that place in time and space, and you feel the wonder that they felt.
Yeah.
It's a really gorgeous membership that you can share those stories. Where can people find you?
So people can find me, Aurora Stories is at aurorastories.co.uk. I, Melanie Windridge, am on like Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and those kind of places. So on Instagram and Twitter, I'm M_Windridge. Uh-huh. And on Facebook, I'm Dr. Melanie Windridge. And those are my personal accounts. And so that's where you'll find a bit of a mixture of like aurora and fusion and mountains, because those are all the things I love. Aurorastories.co.uk is where you'll find the membership.
Oh, fantastic. And your book, Aurora, is that available like on Amazon?
Yeah, so it's called Aurora in Search of the Northern Lights. And it's available, it is on Amazon, but it's available from like any good bookstore, I suppose you would say. You should be able to go into any bookstore and order it.
Well, I'm hoping this lights a spark in some people, because it's such a beautiful phenomenon, just stunning.
Yeah, it really is. And it's always like I said, just so nice for people to be able to get together over something. I love the aurora because it's so multidisciplinary. Like, you know, there's kind of something for everyone in a way. And I love the way that it blends science with art and like nature and all of these things, because I just think that that's what makes it so beautiful. It's not just about the visual or about the technical. It's like it has all of these things, like all yes. wrapped up together. You know, from like I said, the space and people who like art and photography and writing, and it's really inspirational. And so I like the fact that it's like multifaceted. I find that really interesting.
Oh, I completely agree. That is phenomenal.
And actually, speaking about the spiritual things, like there was a lot of spirituality associated with the Aurora. And in the early days, as I said, I got interested in what the polar explorers must have thought when they were seeing something like the Aurora, and like they didn't know what it was scientifically. Like, what would you think it is? And there are lots of feelings of spirituality, I think. Like, you feel gratitude and you feel like awe and so that I think there were a lot of reports in the early days about this spiritual feeling. Like, I think, who was it? Like, I think Robert Falcon Scott said something like, it felt like a departing spirit or something like that. So there was this like real feeling of spirituality. And if you look at the legends and the mythology of the Aurora as well, so from the indigenous people in various parts of the Arctic, there was a lot of spirituality there, or they thought, like a lot of them said that the Aurora was like dead relatives or you know, spirits basically. And there were weird stories. Some of them were their enemies or their unborn children, and some of them were doing weird things like stirring large cooking pots. And you can kind of see where that came from because of the twisting. And
yeah,
there was this, one of the cultures said that their ancestors were playing football with a walrus skull.
Oh,
and that was what the Aurora
Yeah. But, oh my gosh. All the imagery that people could make up at the time for what they knew and what they believed in.
Exactly. But there was this real spirituality about it. And the other thing that was kind of interesting is that up in the north, where it was more commonplace, it wasn't sort of perceived as a threatening thing. It was just a regular thing. But further south, if you see the Aurora further south, it's very rare, but it's also more likely to be red rather than green. Yes. And so there were lots of reports from Europe in the, you know, like 14, 1500s and that kind of thing. And then people would associate it with blood or fires. And so it was usually a bad omen.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Much more ominous. Whereas you don't get that in the north, where it's a bit more commonplace and it's green. Yeah. It's a sort of more gentle spirituality thing, which you can understand it when you go yourself, because you sort of feel it too.
Oh, yes. Once you're touched by it, I'm sure you'd carry that with you through all time.
Definitely.
Oh, my gosh. Well, thank you so much for telling me all about it and sharing your story. I'm so excited to learn more about it.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, guys, after the interview was finished, Melanie and I kept talking about both of our businesses and our interests, and the conversation just went so well, I had to add it on here at the end. So listen in for us talking about connections and just how it doesn't matter what you've done in life, we can all relate to each other.
Important, whatever the subject is, and particularly for something like cancer, where people might feel very alone and frightened, and to have that kind of support is like even more important. And they might not know people to go to in their own like inner circle, and so having something or somewhere where they can go and like you say, listening to other people's stories is the best way to do it, rather than like having a fact sheet of like how to deal with something.
Exactly. Yeah. And my big goal that I've found is that people don't understand that it presents itself so many different ways. There are innumerable ways that it presents, and then the treatment options and things like that. But people think that it's one way, and then they do a comparison and a value. They put comparison and value to those different things. And then they say, well, oh, I don't belong. I don't deserve to receive support because I didn't have it as bad as her. Or my goal through this podcast is just to present so many different paths. Everybody belongs, and everybody has their own story, and it has value.
Yeah. And I think it's relevant to other people as well. In a couple of ways. Like, firstly, I enjoyed, or I kind of related to your story in the podcast about going running and the marathon or whatever it was that you were doing, and just going like step by step, and how you suddenly realized that that was what you were doing in your cancer journey. And I felt the same thing in other things. I mean, not cancer, thankfully.
Yeah.
But I had some eye surgery last year. I had a detached retina.
Oh, geez.
And it wasn't simple, put it that way. So I ended up having to have surgery three times, like, to fix this this thing. And I remember thinking a really similar thing. In fact, I wrote a blog about it. It's on my website, about, I think it was called something like Just Keep Walking. But it was exactly the same sentiment of what you said.
Yeah.
Which is just like, you know, sometimes things happen that scare us or exhaust us or, you know, challenge us in whatever way. And mm-hmm. and I was like, I'm not going to promise that I'm going to like not cry or anything, but I know that I'm just going to keep walking and I'm going to deal with it. And I felt that I've done other things in my life that have sort of helped me in that way, like prepare for that. But mm-hmm. I really I got it completely when you said that.
Oh, good.
I was like, yes. You know, it's so relevant, or like resonates with people in different ways.
Oh, yay. I'm thrilled to hear that. Thank you.
Yeah. So. And the other thing that's useful for like non-cancer patients or survivors is that like people don't always know what to do if they have a friend or a family member or like somebody that they know who suddenly has cancer, and like that could be really challenging for them. And so even for other people, just like, because it's a bit like with death and things as well, sometimes I don't feel that we talk about death enough anymore, and then it becomes awkward and you think like, oh, how do I express to somebody that actually like I care for them and I want to help them, because I don't want to make it awkward. And I don't know, someone said to me just the other day, I've got a friend whose father died sadly 3 years ago, and she's of Irish descent, and she said to me the other day, she was like, oh, the Irish, it's just like they're really okay with death. And so you go into a pub and they'll say, oh, I'm really sorry, like, you know, your dad died, how are you doing, whatever. And she said, whereas the people at work who weren't Irish, she's in London, she said, like, just completely ignored it, like, didn't know what to say.
Yeah.
And it's, I think it could be the same thing for cancer as well. Like, some people just wouldn't know what to say and they might just ignore it. And it's not because they don't care. It's just because they don't know what to do or say.
Yeah. Yeah. You're exactly right. Trying to talk about those things that would be considered taboo, but trying to make them, it's as much a part of life as it is death. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's great. I think that we should talk about these kind of things. And death is hard, of course, but death is something that we all have to deal with. I don't mean dying. I mean, losing loved ones is something we're all going to have to deal with, because it's like unavoidable. And yet for some reason, we don't really want to talk about it. And I remember, so I climbed Everest actually a few years ago, and which was amazing. Did you see? Yeah, it was amazing. But of course, like there's the death shadow, if you like that's hanging over you all the time, particularly with family. And I think for me, it was one of the hardest things, because I felt that I couldn't talk to my family. I felt that I was just like really alone, because I knew that my family didn't want me to go anyway. I mean, they were really supportive. It's just like nobody, I mean, if look at it from a parent's perspective, no parent wants their child to spend like the deposit they could put down on a house on something that might kill them.
Right, right.
It's like not the ideal scenario. So family's never particularly happy about it, even though they were super supportive of me. And I'm really grateful for that. But we just couldn't talk about death. And if I said, I couldn't say that I had any like fears, because if that came up, the answer is like, well, don't do it then. Like, why would you do it?
Yeah. And it's not a black and white answer.
Yeah, exactly. There's not a black and white answer. It's like, I'm doing this thing. I have to do this thing. And you just want to like be able to get through it. And fortunately, you know, again, it's good to make communities. I knew other climbers. Not that we really spoke about death, but at least you have kind of, you have support there. You have people who understand you. But yeah, the death thing is hard. Like, I really felt like I wanted to talk about something with my family and I couldn't, because mm-hmm. it was going to hurt them as well. But I do think those conversations are important. And the more that we can like break down the taboos and open these kind of conversations up, the better it will be, I think.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. So
yours is going to be really important.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I can't wait for the evolution. I'm in the one day at a time, midst of the process. So
thank you guys so much for joining Melanie and I today for this super special edition of the Super Bad Podcast. I hope that it lit a little spark. I know that I became super interested in the Aurora after this and would love to see it someday. You never quite know what you're going to be interested in when you open up your eyes and you open up your heart to new possibilities. Thanks guys so much for listening. I appreciate you and all the connections that this podcast is making. And if I can help one person feel more connected and not alone, then my mission is accomplished. So I will see you guys all next week.